As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello everyone, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. After 7 weeks, 48 matches, a whole load of pods, this is our final dispatch from out here in France. It's Sunday in Paris, the day after South Africa have won the World Cup for a fourth time, beating their great rivals New Zealand in a gripping final. I'm Alfie Reynolds, and who else would be alongside me other than Alex Lowe, Will Kelleher, Stephen Jones. Guys, we all right?
Oh, we're brilliant. Full of beans.
No, we're good.
We're obviously going to get into looking back on this World Cup, the final, a few other bits and bobs as well. But I suppose to kick things off, first question to you all. On our preview pod, we spoke a lot about hoping to get the final to finish off this World Cup. A brilliant game. It had so much potential. What did you make of the finale that we got?
I think there might be some disagreement on this. Because I've read Steve's match report this morning and you didn't like it at all, did you?
No. It had no run of play in it whatsoever, no continuity. And what we always feared happened, and that is that the new stipulations regarding on safety or to build up safety in rugby were always going to come and haunt the tournament, and they did it in the final in the most graphic way.
You see, I thought it was a gripping contest. And I felt, as I reflected on it afterwards, it felt less of a rugby match and more of a saga. There was, like, for a game that finished 12-11, there was an extraordinary amount packed into it. It didn't have the free-flowing rugby that everyone always dreams of, but the rain was hammering down. Mistakes were high, but I thought there was so much else that makes up our game that was outstanding, and a lot of it came from players like Peter Steph Dutoit defensively, 28 tackles, smoking people from first minute to last. Ardy Surveyor leading the All Blacks' resistance when they'd gone down to 14 men, and we can discuss the cards situation in a minute, but I feared there was a point in the first half where I feared it was going to be a Springbok blowout. I feared it was going to end up 30-6. But the fact that it went right to the wire again, for me, was just as compelling and just as fascinating as some of the more exhilarating, free-flowing rugby games we've had. I loved it, and I thought all the subplots through it were fascinating.
Did it kind of sum up rugby in our current era in 2023? Like, desperately arguing over cards, no one knowing whether it's a red, a yellow, a penalty only, nothing.
That is true.
Loads of that. And also, a grippingly tense game that's really close against two teams that aren't... It's hard to say this, maybe, but I don't think they're both absolute vintage versions of the Springboks or the All Blacks, possibly. And the Springboks could argue that because they're double World Cup winners and won a Lions series. But
what if that game had been played in balmy conditions?
Yeah.
It would have been a totally different game.
No, I don't agree with that.
You don't agree?
So I don't agree with that.
Neither
team were anything remotely near. And we're talking about, you know, summed up modern day rugby. Modern day rugby was reinvented. There's been seven games in this tournament, five of which I would consider to be some of the greatest of all time, or would be in the top 10. We were back to this halting stuff, endless references, either live or privately, to the TMO, endless going back to did he hit him head to head, did he dip one inch, and all that.
Yeah, but that
and what happened was that the court case threatened against rugby has haunted them forever. And yesterday, the spectre of it was over everything.
Well, we're talking about two different things now. We could absolutely have a conversation about the card decisions. What I'm saying is that I think South Africa would have played how South Africa play with the team they picked, but that was partly driven by the fact they knew it was going to rain. I think New Zealand's execution, their accuracy, wasn't as good as it usually is. Part of that is because they always had Peter Steph-Tutoit a millisecond away from smashing them, but also the conditions weren't as conducive to the way that they play. I do think the game would have been different. I think New Zealand would have forced the running a bit more. Yeah, they had a lot of the ball in that second half, but were a man down and just ran into a trap.
They didn't have a line-out. They made the fatal error of having a big lump in the line-out they couldn't lift. It took them way too long to bring Sam Whitelock on. They had no line-out, and they made so many handling errors. I mean, the All Blacks, not as if the All Blacks don't play in rain, Alex, every week.
Well, we're 6 minutes into the pod, and I think it gives quite a good insight of just the amount of stuff there is to get into in this final, which we are going to do. Obviously, we'll look back on the final. We'll also mention England's bronze as they beat Argentina, although I'm sure you can understand that's not going to be top of the bill. We'll name a god or goddess of the week, and we'll also reflect on the World Cup as a whole as the curtain closes on France 2023. But first up, let's get properly stuck in to that final. So as we just said in the opening 6 minutes there's refereeing decisions, there's so many different moments of this game that we can discuss in detail. Let's get on to the officiating in a moment. Overall, when you look at this Springboks team and the victory, the pool they've had to come through, winning all of their knockout games by a point, is it the greatest run to a World Cup victory that we've ever seen?
One of the hardest, having the number one ranked team in the world before the tournament in your pool and the fifth, then going, having to beat the hosts, then another 1-point win, and then another 1-point win in the final, albeit against 14 for a lot of it, is one of the harder runs to win the World Cup, isn't
it? Yeah, Razzy was talking in the England week about how you can win a World Cup by getting an easy route through, which is really what the Boks did in 2019. You know, they lost to the All Blacks early, and then they played
Japan,
and then they played Wales, and won an arm wrestle, and then beat England. That was as relatively soft a route to winning it as is available. Now, that's not to undermine what they did and where they came from in a relatively short space of time, but this route to winning it required them to dig a lot deeper physically and think a lot harder tactically. And, you know, we've talked all through this tournament about Springbok coaches being innovative / pushing the boundaries. There was a moment yesterday we thought we might see another one when Bongi came off, and he was noted on the card as being a tactical replacement as he hobbled off and went into the changing room, clearly had about a million jabs in his knee, came back out and was warming up with the team again, and you started to wonder whether there's going to be an HIA which would allow him back on. Didn't happen, but they've thought deeply tactically in order to get over the line, and that's that squad rotation, that's depth, that's lots of things, and they've taken chances which have actually paid off for them.
I think the mentality to go again, again, and again in three knockout games against two very, very, very high performing teams and one who had grown, England, throughout the tournament and gave them a hell of a game is remarkable. And the other thing to it too, I think I'm right in saying that no team has beaten New Zealand and England at the World Cup in the same tournament. So I know England aren't the vintage England they have been, but they've done a lot of things for the first time. Like, they've won World Cup back-to-back. It's interesting, I was saying to you, Alex, in the stands after the game, they've almost done the reverse of what New Zealand did with their two back-to-back wins. New Zealand did their nipper first, the 8-7 in Eden Park against France, and then they did their sort of, like, glorious, brilliant win in the final against Australia in 15, whereas South Africa kind of did the brilliant win in 2019, 32-12, and then the nipper this time. But, I don't know, the mindset to go through that tournament, lose to Ireland, then 1-point win, 1-point win, 1-point win, with not much of a fair win behind them. That's a pretty good effort, I think.
I thought they were fortuitous in many of those games. And all last night, I was thinking of one team, the team that was really, really distraught last night, and that was France. France,
yeah, agree.
Technically and in all other respects, were the best team out here. They should have won it. They made a total mess in defence in the first half against South Africa and couldn't get back. I think France were 5% better than any other team in the World Cup, and I don't think either of the two teams played yesterday, in dry or wet, were as great as their countries have fielded by any means.
But the brutal thing about that is obviously South Africa beat them, and they largely because they couldn't catch the ball. Like 21 points in that game, France South Africa came from high bombs, France not being able to catch them, and South Africa scoring immediately. Like, I agree, I totally agree, and I would have loved to have seen France in the final, but they did play against the Springboks and they did lose by a point and they couldn't get over the line. So that's, we've talked about it endlessly throughout this World Cup, but World Cups are crazy. They're mad. They don't go often the way you think they're going to go. There's something that happens that's different. So we would all love to see France, but ultimately they didn't deserve to win the World Cup because they messed up on the big day.
And one thing that, when you spoke to Francois Loh, Will, for your series of how to win the World Cup, looking back on that victory 4 years ago in 2019, something he said was that he felt that they weren't able to capitalise on it because COVID happened so shortly after it, the world shut down, economies were troubled. And I just kind of hope with this victory, it gives South Africa almost like a pleasing thing from it, is it gives them another opportunity to capitalise on it.
So I think that there's two halves to this, and you've got to be careful because we're not South Africans, obviously. We don't live in South Africa. We don't know really the reality of that country's politics and history and everything. We know about it from afar, but we don't know about it firsthand. And I think there's something that you can kind of separate here. So Siya Kolisi after the game was absolutely extraordinary in the press conference, wasn't he? He gave two unbelievable speeches. One, yeah, it was basically a how do you feel first question, and then he gave what, like a 3 or 4 minute speech about the beautiful broken country that he comes from, inspiring people like he did in 2019, all the places that the people have come from in the side and all that. And you just sit there and you just go, your jaw's dropped, and you think, oh my god, this guy's one of the great captains and almost politicians of all time. So he's an extraordinary character and leader and just an amazing figure for the sport, isn't he? But then I think there's a separate thing here. Some of this is coming from South Africans. It's not just people from outside the tent, where I think the way that South Africa have won over the last 4 years has left a sour taste. And that's not, I can already see millions of Springbok supporters coming in the comments and saying, oh, sour grapes, salty
tough,
English.
Tough luck.
It's, I think they've trampled on a lot over the last 4 years, morally and with lots of things around Razzie Erasmus, the way he's treated referees, the way he's incited pylons on social media on purpose, the way he's used things to his advantage, Machiavellian. And that is not just my opinion. I know that's an opinion of people high up in the game in South Africa as well. I personally don't feel the joy maybe that you could have felt in 2019 when we didn't know about all that stuff. Like the stuff that's happened in the British and Irish Lions series and since, a lot of the skullduggery around the things that they've been doing over the last 4 years has to be part of this story. And I don't, and I think that's not an unfair thing to say.
They've all failed to attend their non-arrogant seminars for a start. I've never met such an arrogant bunch on and off the field. Razzie Erasmus has been a disgrace. People are saying he should be coming as England coach. I wouldn't touch him with a barge pole. He's got no concept of fairness. He never apologised to Wayne Barnes. It's absolutely despicable. And that is why it's a bad thing for rugby that they won. Good thing for their rugby, but they can stew in whatever they want over there. The other thing is they're gone. They're done now, because it is very rare to bring the same team or almost the same team to two World Cups. There is no way they can come to a third without massive changes, because a lot of those guys will be gone.
There will be loads of changes, I suppose, in the back room, because Jacques Nienaber, which is extraordinary, really, double World Cup winning coach, and he's going to be the assistant at Leinster from next season. Felix Jones is going to England, and that looks like an incredible appointment by Steve Borthwick there, who's done amazing things, and he's only 36, and he's got two World Cups in the back pocket as well. You'd imagine that certainly guys like Dwayne Vermeulen and Dion Faree and maybe Etzebeth and quite a lot of the other forwards, Peter Steffi-Toy, they're not going to be there in 27. Kolisi, I doubt, too.
None of the props.
Kolisi's going to Racing and is going to be playing with he's going to be playing with Fiku, Tuasova and Arundel in that side, as well as all sorts of others. So yeah, it's going to be a lot of movement. If Springboks fans are listening to this, they'll probably say, oh, look, you're all just being so sour. You hate the fact that South Africa win. I don't think that's right, but I think that there's... I'm not saying this is world rugby as in the organisation, but I think the rugby world outside South Africa sigh a bit when South Africa win World Cups in the way they do. And that's not an indictment on how they do it. It's just defence winning championships and being hard and physical and stuff isn't the... It's not the... Whether it's right or wrong, it's not the image that rugby wants to project. The image that rugby wants to be and protect is families, rugby values. But the actual reality of rugby is it's an absolutely brutal, savage sport. It's like combat, and it doesn't lean into it because it doesn't want to, because of the things that Steve mentioned about the concussion and the lawsuits and stuff like that. And actually, it's getting decided on massive forwards and physicality and size and kicking well and cards. And that's what I think I meant at the start about rugby in 2023. I think it got this World Cup and this era of rugby got the final that encapsulated everything about where we are in the game at the moment. How are we in this position?
Because two years ago, neither of the offences which led to a card and a red card, a yellow card, would even have been a penalty. There would not have been a penalty because refs wouldn't have been looking for them, and it's not really a high shot anyway if you hit someone with your shoulder.
But I think we want
to be.
Wouldn't
even have been penalties.
We want to be constructive. We don't want to just sort of offer problems. We want to offer solutions. But on a Sunday morning after a World Cup final, I'm struggling to think where rugby goes next. I don't know quite how we get out of this malaise of everything's about refereeing decisions. I don't know what you think, Alex.
Well, rugby inherently is a sport where it can't be black and white.
Yeah.
And some of the problem.
But they want it to be, don't
they? Some of the problem is that the more you use the TMO and frame-by-frame replays, you're asking for black-and-white decisions in a sport which comes down a lot to how the referee sees it at the time within the context of the game that's being played at that moment. Now, Sam Kane was sent off for shoulder to the head, and he can't complain about it. For me, there's argument whether there was mitigation because of a change of direction, but he didn't dip. So he's already in a position where that can happen. And the way the game goes forward is that you get more players like Courtney Laws, who was never yellow carded or red carded for a high tackle, and yet was one of the most destructive defenders in the game. For 15 years. Always went low. We saw, what was the game earlier in the tournament? France, South Africa? Not a single TMO referral. Like, it can happen. But the onus, whether you like it or not, the onus is being put on the players to put themselves in a situation. And we are at a point where at the last World Cup, it was pretty clear because they didn't really factor in mitigation. You just knew what was coming. Now, they've tried to balance it. The players and the coaches have gone, what we had 4 years ago was too harsh, so we need to build mitigation in. And now no one knows. No one knows what's coming. And you've got, exactly as Will says, people at home going, it was just a rugby incident.
I've seen that, but the interpretations, it can, as you say, can never be black and white because sometimes you see people being still banned and still sent off, even though they made a real effort to get lower, but didn't. Khaleesi didn't make any effort to get lower. He bent his head, and he may have, oh great, he went into a tackle and he sunk his hips a bit. Well, that's what you do for every tackle that was ever made. And the problem is, it can't be black and white. It is a matter of interpretation, because I've seen people sent off the field for getting way lower than Khaleesi did for his tackle.
You know what's going to happen. Will says, what's the future? What will happen is that the legal tackle height will go down to the sternum like it is currently being in the community game in England. Because I can't, and this is not me advocating it necessarily, but I do believe that the only way that you get clarity, like at the moment, the difference between a red and nothing is centimetres. Now, if the tackle height is down to the sternum, you've got a much bigger cushion between the legal tackle height and someone's chin. But rugby's at a point where it hasn't gone there yet. So just to reprise a conversation that we'd have had 2 months ago, being upright in a tackle is not illegal unless you clock heads with the ball carrier. Now, there's a counter-argument. The ball carrier has some responsibility as well in this because it's, you can't place everything on the defender when the ball carrier can shift last minute. But to answer Will's question, where's it going to go by the next World Cup? I would be amazed.
Lower.
If the legal tackle height is not the sternum in pro rugby by the next World Cup.
If you feel sorry for the referees, I'm sure it was a big day for them, but bloody hell, what a horrific game
but
to referee.
You know Wayne Bard's better than most journalists, Jonesy. I don't think there's any better mark of the man than the way he managed that game, A, with the tension and the number of decisions that had to be made in that game, not just card decisions, but it was a street fight. So not only the way he managed the game as it was on the day, but the way he managed the game that contained a team who a year earlier had gone so public with their complaints that it triggered a horrific pile on him and his family. I don't think there's any better mark of the man that he dealt with the game as he did, despite
of that. I just texted him this morning to say, what is it about the 6 foot 10, 40 yards offside Edmund Estabeth that you didn't actually spot? apart from that, well done, mate.
But like, I was listening to the ref mic for a lot of it, and his communication was remarkably good, to the point where that really, really sickeningly tense last scrum that got reset, he was talking to both the front rows, where everyone knows that that's the scrum of your life for the World Cup, and he was so calmly going, keep high, do your job, concentrate on your jobs, everyone, all that stuff, and you're just like, amazing sort of calmness from him.
There was a point in the middle of this like epic tense game where he just went, oh, stop raining, lads.
Yeah, he did. With Khaleesi, while Pollard was lining up a goal. That was really funny,
I think what you guys all touched on there is so true as well, in that a lot of what we saw last night is a reflection of where rugby is at the moment. In that, for example, the Sam Kane one, I'm kind of with you, Alex, in that I looked at it, I thought, I feel brutal for him. It's awful to happen first half of a World Cup, but I think it's a red card. Whereas then I went into the press room at halftime and you just kind of overhear other conversations. And I heard even South African voices saying, surely there was mitigation there because Creel moved. And then likewise, the Khaleesi one, I didn't think should have even been a yellow card. I thought the contact first was on the ball, and people said maybe that should be upgraded to a red. So I think with all these decisions, we'll all see it so differently. And actually, will you indulge me in just a little rant?
Come on, Alfie.
You guys know me fairly well. I'm not exactly the ranting type, and it was something I was going to...
He knocked out the receptionist in the hotel. I couldn't believe it.
Well, when they said that we had to wait 20 minutes to record in here.
What do you mean you're hoovering?
Go on.
I was going to bring this up anyway, but it seems quite apt after the final we've just seen and the amount of big decisions that there were. But I just feel like one of my takeaways from this World Cup is that rugby's in quite a dangerous position in terms of the treatment of officials and the attitude towards them. And I think this is across the game, from coaches, players, pundits, fans. And I was trying to think of various different examples to make my point, but before every match that I've been at this World Cup, they announce the teams and then they announce the officiating team. And it is a chorus of boos every time. And I get a part of that is pantomime and whatever, but even so, I think it is a reflection of the bigger picture. And if you follow any match on social media, there will be fans of both sides, by the way, complaining about every minute detail. Did that player release? Were they in at the side? Was it a forward pass? You've got ex-players and pundits and everyone posting stills and slow motion replays about every single decision. And then even if you look back at this weekend, we had Michael Checker being pretty punchy about what he thought of the officiating in the England game. You had Antoine Dupont, I think, making some pretty badly timed comments when France got knocked out. And I think that just fuels this kind of criticism and negativity and then abuse, as we've just mentioned, as we've seen with Wayne Barnes before, towards the officials. And I think there are really important and worthwhile conversations that we can have. I saw Mark Evans tweet last night about, obviously, they've brought in this the laws around the tackle height to try and change behaviour. It's not changing behaviour, and there's a worthwhile discussion to be had there. Maybe there's even a discussion across the board to say that officiating needs to improve, and we can have conversations about how to get there. But I just feel like at the moment we're heading down just a really, really bad path. And I understand, I'm not naive, sometimes you have to talk about big decisions and sometimes referees will get those decisions wrong and we have to talk about that. But at the moment, it seems to just be leading to a pile on and every single moment being put under a microscope, and it's not going to lead us anywhere worthwhile or constructive.
Yeah, there's a... How do you balance that, Alfie, with what can be really interesting discussions around, like, a referee's made a decision from what you've seen on the day, and I think we would all say that any debate thereafter has to be done within the context of thanks to the referee for even being there and respect the job that they're doing.
Yeah.
But we had last week, after the Box England game, Alex Corbisiero in our paper analysing the scrums and how the scrum shifted in that game, and then looking at the final decision and why that final scrum decision went to South Africa. Then separately, David Flatman, another expert in the area, came up with an opposite conclusion. He saw it differently.
Well, I'll tell you what, boys, we wouldn't want to be the four officials out there, would we?
Absolutely.
We wouldn't want them.
So for me, I found that whole conversation fascinating because it's minute details, and the referees collectively are having to manage that situation. I don't think there's a problem with discussing a lot of decisions.
Agreed.
But I do think there needs to be a wider acceptance. There needs to be a wider acceptance. The referees aren't there to make black and white perfect decisions at every breakdown. They're there to manage the game within the context of the game. So if that player is coming from the side but has had no material impact, play on. Mm. And that's what the referee's trying to make a decision all the time.
That's a good way to end the refereeing dispute. I think that's perfectly correct. And if we did manage to get in that direction, it would be better for everybody. All I wanted yesterday was for someone to be 50 points ahead at halftime.
So you could write your match report.
I've had five night matches now where no one knew who was going to win 1 minute before the end. And the officer going, have you filed yet? Yeah, no, I'm just about to file, but I don't know who's won.
but that comes back like, it's a Sunday morning and I'm tired, so maybe I'm being a bit much. But like, as we keep saying, these knockout games have been absolutely amazing.
Yeah, like, and that's where I think
all but one of them were so cripplingly tight.
And there are a multitude of ways of enjoying a game of rugby, and that's the very few occasions you get a pure game. Now, I do think that South Africa France game with no TMOs and no high shots was a rare example of a game of incredible intensity, superb rugby, where the conversation wasn't about anything else. That's a rarity. You know, we all love watching Fiji play, and we love watching Portugal play. That's not the only way to play rugby.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
And I do think my one concern about this being where rugby is the contestable kick has become one of the most dominant tactics in this game, in this World Cup. We saw a lot of it on Saturday night in the World Cup final because of the conditions. And you kick it high, you try and win it, it was England's failing in that semi-final. They kept going at it when a knock-on on either side was, you know, shooting themselves in the foot because the scrum was going bad. I don't want rugby to be played like that all the time. But it doesn't mean I didn't really enjoy last night. And I think particularly from that moment where I feared that the box were going to just blow the All Blacks out of the water, it was going to be 34-6. When that didn't happen, that's what I loved about it.
I think Alex has articulated it better. Like, I'm not saying I didn't enjoy the game, and it absolutely is a privilege to be here and for the whole time. But I just think, yeah, it summed up where we are. But it doesn't mean that I want it to be 78-80 and loads of tries and all that.
Will needs a cuddle, I think, is what the audience
should say that. The All Blacks played fantastically, considering.
Yeah. And let's actually move on to the All Blacks as well. Obviously, the Sam Kane red card. When that happened, I felt like, obviously, it's not a good thing losing a player, but it could almost benefit them in that I thought tactically in that first half, the All Blacks got their game plan a little bit wrong. I thought they were trying to play with it too much. I think they had 60% possession, and Sam Kane getting red carded forced them to approach it in a different way.
But their line-out was terrible. They didn't have a line-out. And they just didn't start well. They always try and make that first ball a score if they can. They whiz it all over the place. South Africa were waiting for them. But also, you see, this new law where you refer things above, you've got 10 minutes where you think, oh, right, okay, we're losing someone for 10 minutes. But you think, well, hang on, has he gone for good? The first sin bin with Frizzell, you've got this long period where you don't know whether he's coming back or not. Then you lose your captain, and it's so disruptive. And that's why they did so well. They must have said some good words at half time, because second half, third quarter, they came out and they played like the All Blacks.
But on the yellow cards for the All Blacks then, I remember after the first weekend in Marseille and the England red card, and England had another red card, and our conversation around that was, when it keeps happening to the same team, look at what is the consistent factor. And you look at New Zealand through this World Cup and through these knockout stages, Will, they have consistently picked up yellow cards.
And through last year, like, they lost the Ireland series with red cards, didn't they? They had a couple of, went down to 13 at one point, didn't they, in that Ireland series? And I think this is also a point that we made around Owen Farrell, is that, as Alex has said, it doesn't happen to everyone, this. It doesn't happen to Courtney Laws. You don't get lots of South Africans being red carded for massive... Like, Rabie Netsebeth doesn't hit people in the face and get sent off. But there are some players and there are some teams that are really ill-disciplined. Whether we agree with the strictures or not, they got it wrong. I think the other thing I would say is that I think in the cold light of day, Sunday morning, flying back to New Zealand, the one thing that will absolutely gut the New Zealanders about is that their skills let them down. Like, the absolute thing they've always been the best at in the world is skills under pressure. And the thing that let them down was skills under pressure. And that is brutal if you're an All Black. Like, dropping the ball, not fizzing passes in front of the guy, just slightly behind, which lets the blitz defence come on. But having said that, Imagine if that Richie Mwanga try had been... Well, sorry, the Aaron Smith try that Richie Mwanga set up was allowed. That would have been one of the great World Cup final tries. That was so good. Like the way he drifted off the blitz defence like a matador, went through, found a little outside gap, had the pace, then flicked the ball inside.
He was sort of going backwards when he got the ball in order to step Curtly Lorenzo, wasn't it? And I mean, it was awesome. If it wasn't for that tiny little fingertip knock-on in the line-out...
Tiny.
The conversion gets kicked. That's the other thing. When they did score, they scored wide.
Yeah.
And they left 5 points out there for missed kicks.
Yeah.
Jordy Barrett, you'd have put money on him getting that penalty that went wide. Then there's a whole other conversation around the tactical decisions that they made to kick for the corner instead of kicking points at 12-6 down and a man down, and they kick for the corner to try and maul the Springboks back over their own line. I can understand maybe doing it once. Second time, I think you take the points.
And they didn't.
I think in a final in the rain, you take the points.
It's funny, I know it was raining, but in the old days, or not that long ago, a conversion from the touchline was really, really rare. But actually, they've become incredibly common, especially in this tournament. And the conversion of the try was a really poor attempt, missed by Miles. So there we go.
I would also say, so goal kicking is a Kiwi problem. I think too. They lost a line series in 2017. Well, sorry, they didn't win a line series in 2017 because Bowden Barrett missed a few really clutch kicks, and Owen Farrell got his. Andre Pollard has kicked South Africa to two World Cups now. Goal kicking is a problem for them, and also
drop goals.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is maybe reading too much into it, but it almost feels like they're too good to drop goals.
That was always the case when in that World Cup quarterfinal.
Well, they think they're good, 07, too good
when they didn't beat France. And they could have done, but they just wouldn't take a drop goal, thinking they'd score the try. Now, it was interesting, on last night, the box tried three sort of opportunistic shots. None of them.
Amazing charge down on a Pollard one.
Yeah, and that was key, actually, that charge down. But when the Blacks were down the other end, they were never looking for it.
There were moments where they could have gone for it.
There were moments when they could, but they wouldn't. It's not like the end of the England game against South Africa when they knew they would needed to get into position, but they just couldn't quite get the 15 yards that they needed. New Zealand had windows to do it,
definitely,
but it wasn't in their mind. And again, you know, a one-score game or one-point game in the rain, take the point. You take the points that are on offer. Take the drop goal. If you're playing advantage, which happened a few times,
It's not below them either, because Dan Carter did it in 2015. He hardly hit any in his career, but he did when it mattered.
In the final.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, an interesting final then. Some split opinions on the pod about it. I think, Alex, I agree with you. I thought the first 40 minutes I was there like, oh no, is this going to really underwhelm? But then I don't think I've ever been so nervous watching the second half for a game where I wasn't supporting either side. But we'll park it.
I'll just interrupt you. My only disappointment was in my big preview in the morning, I teed it up as this could be the best final since 03, maybe longer. And so my fear through that first half was that it was all going to just slide away as a damp squib because of the cards. And what I then loved about it was that I actually think it did deliver one of the best finals, if not the since 03.
Well, we'll leave it there then on the final. Congratulations to South Africa. Missed opportunity for the All Blacks, maybe. That's the way it goes sometimes. Up next, we'll mention England getting the bronze medal, which everyone wants to get at the World Cup.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
So, England 26, Argentina 23, not a great game. A reminder, really, of whilst England have made progress at this World Cup, that there is still a lot they need to build upon heading forward.
Just hang on a second, Alfie. I've seen a lot of the third and fourth place games, yeah, and that was far from the worst.
Yeah.
Far from the worst.
I was going to say the same thing.
It was, and 77,000. I mean, what a crowd. I actually thought it was quite a satisfyingly decent game, actually, having said that about the final. I do think that I'm glad that England got something for everyone back at home and kids and volunteers. I do think Argentina blew it in a big way, especially by not going for a drive over try when they got a penalty, which they missed, because their forwards at the time were absolutely dominant and they were playing like an Argentina pack for the first time. I'm glad that England won. I think that Checa would be absolutely furious that Argentina didn't.
He was, yeah.
I think the best third place game was back here in 07 when Argentina turned on the style to beat France. That was at the Parc des Princes, and it was a thrilling occasion. This wasn't thrilling, but what made it for me a good game was it did matter to both teams. Mm-hmm. We've sat through bronze medal games, happened 4 years ago, 8 years ago, where the two losing semi-finalists don't want to be there. They're trudging through a low grade contest just to get to the end of it and have a beer. This wasn't like that. This actually mattered to both teams. I felt that England were fortunate in a way, like having opened a 13-point lead early. I thought they sort of ran out of steam a bit. It was like the exertions of the week before. I know there were a number of different players, and they went into a sort of containment mode quite a long way out. It felt a bit like watching Palace, where they had Patrick Vieira as manager. They took a 1-0 lead and then basically play everyone behind the ball. You're just inviting trouble. And they got away with it a bit because Nicolas Sanchez missed that penalty. They got away with just inviting the Pumas onto them for about the last 20 minutes. But, you know, they've for a five-month project, to come away with a bronze medal was the height of anyone's expectations, I think. Like, we all, through August when they were dreadful, we all said they're dreadful, but there's every chance I make the semi-finals. If you make the semi-finals, they were going to play an Argentina or a
Wales
in the third place playoff. So they've maxed out on what they can do from a 5 month project. It doesn't make them the third best team in the world. It means that they're the best team on that side of the draw. Really, they sort of won the second tier side of the draw because there were better teams that didn't, as we discussed earlier, from the other side like France and Ireland who didn't make it through.
Pumped for Rome in 10 weeks.
Is that Six Nations opener?
Yeah. England in Rome.
I am really interested, actually, to see now how it evolves with England. There'll be a handful of players who are retiring. We know of three already: Ben Youngs, Courtney Laws, Johnny May. Joe Marler, Dan Cole expected to follow. Marler's sort of semi-officially announced it by asking Ben Youngs to announce on his behalf because he didn't think we'd believe him if he announced his retirement, having already done it at least once.
Cried wolf.
So there'll be some ageing players going, but some of the, you know, Ben Earl was England's best player at this World Cup, 25. George Martin had he was carrying a knee injury early, got that okay to play an absolute humdinger of a semi-final. Ollie Chesham, really good tournament. You know, there's a core of players who've really made a mark at this World Cup.
You mentioned Marler. Jack Marler would be one of my favourite England players on this tournament. I ran into him just before the tournament when he didn't know whether he was going to go for it or not. I said, and I actually thought at the time, Joe, you've been a really, really good servant, but this thing about, well, do I want to go, do I not? Why don't you just blast it, go out there? And he did, and he got the place back, and I thought he played wonderfully well.
And from everything you hear, he was really important in that England squad. On that Lions tour, 17, Gatland was a bit disappointed with him, with the way he approached things, his sort of laissez-faire attitude, and that's why he didn't make the...
And assuming he was going to be in the sort of mixed veg team rather than
main... Assuming
when Gatland thought, he could have been a starting loose head prop.
Yeah, and he kind of went there expecting to be a midweeker, and Gatland wasn't that impressed with him. On this trip, he's... By all accounts, from everyone you speak to, he's been a critical senior player. You know, for a guy who's had his own struggles, who you could forgive for going into himself a bit at times on not only an 8-week trip, but a 5-month camp, everyone says that he's been absolutely critical in helping to galvanise.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Galvanise this team from what was a disjointed, dysfunctional group of players at the start of the year, with no idea who they were or what they all stood for. He's been really important in making bringing a certain identity. And it's only a platform. It's only a foundation of they fight for each other to get over the line somehow. That's a start. Like, it's got to get better. Six Nations. There's got to be more layers. There's got to be more to them. But at least they now have that.
And just a word on Ben Youngs, retires as England men's most cap international.
I think it's a remarkable effort for starters to play for England for 13 years through five head coaches, win 127 caps. And I think I looked up that, so Danny Kerr made his debut in 2008. Ben Youngs was 2 years later. In that period, England have played 141 test matches, and Youngs has been part of 127, and Kerr was part of 96. And you think, whatever you thought about them at the time, whatever you could criticise them for throughout that period, to be there all the way, pretty much always being 1 and 2 or 2 and 1 as the number nines, is a great effort.
They've capped 10 scrum halves since he made his debut, plus there were two, so Paul Hodgson didn't play after Ben Youngs made his debut and Danny Carroll was obviously around. I reckon he was at his peak under Eddie Jones. So that era, 2016 to 2019. I would completely agree that where one of the big failings that Eddie Jones made was that he then did not evolve. He did not evolve a succession plan at scrum half. So Ben probably started a whole load of games post-2019 that he probably shouldn't have for the kind of the evolution of the England team. But that is not his fault. And I do think that seeing off 8 or 9 of those 10 scrum halves and being consistently picked is worthy of respect. Whether or not you've always fancied him as England's first choice scrum half, there was frequently a debate about it. And certainly since 2019, I don't think England and Eddie Jones dealt with the scrum half situation well at all. But that's not Ben's fault.
So for England, bronze medal, Ben Youngs with his swan song. Interesting to see how they develop as a team into the future. Next up, we'll finish off our final pod in France. We will give our closing thoughts on the 2023 World Cup, and we'll also name our God or Goddess of the Week. So you guys have all been out here for the full 7 weeks of the tournament. We've kind of spoken about it throughout the tournament, that there's been some brilliant moments, some brilliant rugby, some off-the-field things that maybe haven't gone quite to plan, and we've maybe hinted at it already. But what's your kind of closing sentiments, your feelings, your thoughts on France 2023 as we sit here now?
I think I'll just repeat a little bit what I said on a previous pod, that I think the highs at this World Cup have been really high. I think we've seen some epic games. We've seen some thrilling games involving countries that we know a lot less about, like Portugal. We've seen the emergence of Fiji into the quarterfinals, knocking out Australia. For me, I reflect on it as a series of highlights rather than a body of work, if that makes sense. What you'd want from a World Cup is that you build on it each time, and it was a bit too long, a bit too drawn out, too saggy in the middle. We know that's going to change for next time. I think it was a tough tournament for fans. I think the organisation around the matches, there's just so much like forced fun. You can't go to a game and watch the other game because you've got to have adverts and sponsors on screens and all of that nonsense, which was a shame, I think. I think fans, they made their own fun, but it wasn't made easy for travelling supporters. Of course, it's incredibly expensive. But I think if you're talking purely rugby, there is a case for it being one of the best on-field World Cups because of some of the thrilling storylines we had.
Loads of great games, loads of tight games, probably some of the best knockout games we've ever seen.
Absolutely, yeah.
Didn't love the World Cup as a whole. Loved being here for the Times, loved going around the place, touring, following England around, having plenty of fun around it. Loved being with all you lads, but didn't adore the tournament.
Beating Chris Ashton and Richard Wigglesworth at paddle.
Oh, what a highlight. That's a highlight. Swimming in the sea on the mornings of games, loved that. France is an amazing country, had a great time. But I felt like the whole atmosphere around it, the answer for most things was no. No, you can't do that. No, you can't be here. No, you can't stand there. No, you can't buy that. No, that's not free. No, you can't do this. No, you can't get in at this point. No, you can't do that. It was all a bit sort of overzealous and a bit kind of... And I worry that that's going to keep happening and everything just gets shut out. And it's this sort of, the experience of actually being at the World Cup isn't brilliant.
When it was mooted, or when France bid and were accepted, I thought it's going to be the greatest, it's going to be the best. Because, of course, France, the stadiums, which are magnificent, And it wasn't. It's not the greatest. I've been to 10 and it wasn't the greatest. I contemplate whether it's in the top three, really. Stellar rugby, as the boys said. Stellar rugby is a magnificent city, magnificent company. We met great people, saw great rugby, but it was not, in the end, a great World Cup.
In spite of all of that, the crowds were remarkable.
Well, the crowds were brilliant.
At every game, at every level of game, you know, whether you're talking the Ireland fans in Paris, or you're talking a sellout crowd for Georgia against Portugal, the fans were outstanding, and they defied some pretty difficult circumstances early on in the heat wave and late on in the pouring rain. So massive credit to the French public for coming out in in throngs to this. Now, 8 years' time, this World Cup goes to the USA. I don't see how you sell out a 20,000 stadium for Georgia Portugal. We've got to realise how special that side of this was.
Alex, I would actually make another point which failed to sell it for me as a great World Cup, and that is, as you say, and we all know this, the crowds love when the smaller nation scores a try against a tier one nation, or especially when they almost beat them, or when they really resist. That is what the World Cup has always missed. And the bitterly, bitterly disappointing thing for me was when World Rugby announced this much vaunted new look. In terms of the old tier two, it was a total paper exercise. Nothing was written down, nothing was decided, nothing was funded. And I bet you anything, when we come to the next World Cup, it'll be exactly the same.
Well, let's finish things off then. God or goddess of the week, the final one of the World Cup. Who wants to start?
Can I offer a devil?
Of course you can.
Yeah.
Eddie Jones.
Yes.
We have learnt this morning that he's resigned as the Australian head coach. Absolute. What a total, unmitigated disaster that whole thing has been. So many people are waking up in Australia, hanging their heads in shame over the whole thing. What a nightmare. They move heaven and earth to get him there. Hamish McLennan puts his whole reputation on the line for it. They win 2 of 9 tests, get knocked out in the pool stage of the World Cup, argue with everyone. They're seriously disrespectful to some massively important Wallabies, and then he just goes and bins it off.
More than that, they had a plan, Australia.
To win the World Cup?
No, before. They had Dave Rennie in charge, and they had Dan McKellar effectively lined up to be Dave Rennie's replacement. They sacked Dave Rennie, hire Eddie Jones, Dan McKellar becomes a Leicester Tigers head coach, and now they don't know where they're going to go. And they've got the Lions in 2 years, and a World Cup in 4.
I see Eddie as a Dr. Faustus. He sold his soul to the devil. He practiced more than heavenly power permits, as Christopher Marlowe wrote. In the end, when the hour chimed, the devil, Mephistopheles, came back and claimed his soul forever.
Oh, someone follow that.
God of the week, Peter Steph Dutoit.
Yeah,
28 tackles in the World Cup final, and for a few years ago almost lost his leg from a rare condition. Basically had a hematoma in his leg and almost had to have it amputated. So to get through that, get to the World Cup, play rugby again, but then to be the man of the match in the World Cup final and make 28 tackles is an absolutely ridiculous effort.
Was he, in 2019, did he get player of the match?
Dwayne Vermeulen was the
World Player of the Year.
But he was World Player of the Year. He's a big game player, isn't he?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
There you go. I've stolen yours.
Yeah, he's going to be mine. I mean, we've all got to do our players of the tournament. I do think Ardie Sarvea was awesome for the All Blacks yesterday and deserves a name check. And Jordy Barrett was my player of the tournament.
I think he should have been on the list. Oh, no, the list's all silly, but World Player of the Year list.
Jordy Barrett. Yeah, I just think he's...
Instead of Dupont.
Yes, agree. He was awesome for the All Blacks. Actually, probably made the difference between them going home in the quarters and getting as far as they did.
So Peter Steph was mine. Steve, you going to give us a clean sweep? Have you got another name?
I've got a guy who has just been magnificent against the odds. Started slowly, played magnificently on Saturday. Last night, that's Tyrrell Lomax, tight end. I thought he absorbed so much pressure, and in the end, because of him and after he was replaced, the New Zealanders got on top in the scrum. I think he's a world-class player and has had a great tournament.
Well, it's been a pleasure, boys.
Now the end is near.
No, oh, we're getting a song from Will to round us off.
Maybe later.
He has lost it.
It has been a pleasure. Well done, Alfie. You've been a producer almost as good as any of the last five we've had.
Almost.
He tied it together, to be fair, like tying it together where we've got our microphones that don't work in Lille and Marseille and then
it's not your fault,
shambling
though.
About in hotels and legging it around. Fair play. Well done, Alfie. You're our god of the tournament.
But I feel like I'm the Antoine Dupont on the World cry, Player of the Year this year. The undeserving name. Come on.
Also, loads of people have come up to us and said that they're listening, and everybody out there, it's really, we couldn't do it without you, and we don't know your names, but thanks a million for listening. I really, really do appreciate it.
God of the Week is Alfie Reynolds.
It's absolutely not.
Deputy God, Alfie Reynolds.
He's given me a fiver under the desk as well. I can't believe it.
Imagine that, following the World Cup final, and it's me that gets the vote. The least deserving award that I think there's ever been. But it's been a pleasure. We hope you have enjoyed it out here in France. Hope we've been able to give you a pretty good flavour of what it's like on the ground, the atmosphere in the stadium and all that sort of stuff. So make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcast from. We will be back next Monday. We have to turn our attention back towards the Premiership and all other matters in the rugby world. But from the final time from out in France, see ya.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.